Boy, this night is just flying by. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls with the author of 2012, The War for Souls, Whitley Strieber. We're going to take your phone calls this hour now with Whitley Strieber. Whitley, some quick things here. Let me ask you, first of all, any truth to the rumor that Majestic might be a television series?
Yeah, actually, I think there's a possibility of that, TNT is very seriously considering it. And it's going to be set in modern times, and it will be about what Majestic does now, the organization does now. I think it'll be quite fascinating.
So that looks good for maybe what season?
If they do order the pilot, I think it would probably be next summer.
Well, that's exciting.
Or before,
that's exciting.
Even in the spring.
Were you happy with the results of the movie, The Day After Tomorrow, which is based on your nut
butts? Fabulous. The movie, The Day After Tomorrow, was I thought it was a tremendous, exciting movie. And, you know, when it came out, they all said, oh, well, yeah, but it couldn't happen in a week. But that is not true. And that very storm, in my book, it's the Europe bears the brunt of the storm in our book, because it will if that happens. In the movie, of course, they moved it to the United States, and they did that because, you know, this is where the main movie audience is. So, however, there was there have been indications that this very type of extraordinarily sudden change has happened in the past. For example, there's a scientist who studies glaciers in Peru, in the Andes, and in coring down to the base of some of these glaciers, he found plants that had been quick frozen, temperate zone plants that had been frozen so fast that their cells were not burst. In other words, they were frozen like frozen food is frozen. Very, very quickly. Now, here's the kicker. These plants were frozen in just a matter of minutes.
Jeez.
But the glaciers that they are under have been there ever since for 5,200 years, meaning that whatever happened in minutes, and it stayed like that, and it's like that to this day. Now, at the same time that this was happening, and I can't say it was on the same day, I have no idea, the same general time that this was happening, Ötzi, the Iceman, was moving through an alpine meadow in the Tyrolean Alps, a meadow which was snowed in and covered with ice that did not melt until 15 or 20 years ago. Now, that means, to me, that there is something that happens here that has not happened in recorded history, that is extraordinarily powerful, that is very sudden and very huge. And so I think that the possibility exists that the superstorm could be quite real, but I don't think that United States is all that vulnerable to it. I think that the great vulnerability is Europe, and look at what happened in England last summer. They didn't have a summer. And they say, oh, well, the Gulf Stream isn't weakening. I don't think so. I don't think anything could have caused what happened in Britain last summer except a weaker Gulf Stream.
Well, and one day England could be submerged.
It could be submerged, but before it's submerged, that country is extremely vulnerable to weather change, more so even than continental Europe, because England is so far north and is warmed so much more. It's a much warmer climate because it's being flooded with warm water from the Gulf Stream. And if that ends, England becomes like Newfoundland. Going to be very suddenly a much colder climate. It is not going to be a place that can sustain nearly as many as people as live there now. And that could happen next year. next year.
Well, remember the story about the mastodon who was found frozen with food still in its mouth.
Well, yeah, and more of that has been found recently. There were all kinds of basically cockamamie explanations for it, all of which were designed to say the same thing. Oh, it wasn't sudden catastrophe. It had to be much slower, etc. Because scientists, no one likes to look at these things and say it could happen in a few minutes. Because
right. It's
scary.
It is. And
in the scientific community, you don't want to say that because then you go out on a limb and then you risk your career. But these two scientists who I referred to earlier in the show have pretty well gotten it to the point where they have proved that a huge event took place at that time, and it certainly would have quick frozen many, many millions of animals. Absolutely.
Have they come up with possibilities, Whitley? An asteroid hit us.
Yeah, there's some
polar shift
possibilities. One of the most interesting is that it was debris from a supernova, and we know that something sheeted Australia and parts of Asia with gamma rays about 40,000 years ago. And we know that because all of the large animals that lived in Australia at the time, except the human beings, were killed. They were rendered extinct. The
instantly?
Really large animals.
Was it instant?
It was very quick. Instant is maybe. But what if there had been, and there's also a tribe in central Taiwan, a hill tribe, who have very ancient stories that suggest that their tribe saw a supernova in the sky 40,000 years ago, or at about that time. Of course, that's very controversial. But nevertheless, if that happened, then what then happened 15,000 years ago is the much slower debris, the physical debris that was ejected, the ejecta from the supernova, came into our solar system, and some of it impacted our planet. And that's what I was talking about. That would have been what I was talking about earlier. Now, if this is the case, we may be able to calculate back and determine where the wavefront of the expanding supernova is now and figure out if it really did happen. The question would be, how would you get astronomers to lavish telescope time on something like that, especially because of the fact that the probability would be high that you'd never find it. And so that's probably not going to happen, but it's a fascinating theory. Otherwise, maybe it was a comet. It wasn't a meteor. It wasn't a metal object that hit the Laurentian, the Mississippian glacier. It was something that dissolved and disintegrated as soon as it hit. It impacted with great force, but then it disintegrated.
All right, to the phones we go. Wild card line, you're on the air with Whitley Strieber. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
We're great, thanks.
Hi, I had a question. I'm from the States. However, my husband and I had a expatriate job overseas in Singapore. And have you heard about they're called over there the round eye, and they're it's almost like the Asians are accepting to it that they are alien or ETs, and they just live amongst the people and they accept it, and they live in so they're round eye, round head, round eye, and they tend to live in round houses. And have you heard about that?
Not at all.
Unfortunately,
I wish I had. It's fascinating. Tell us more.
Well, my husband actually knows more about it, but it is of course, a different culture. And a lot that I learned over there was about not only that fascinated me, there were a lot of that my husband and I saw, like dark, we'd see dark running objects at night on our bikes in Singapore that would just kind of go, we both would see them. And that's to be spirits.
You mean like shadowy little objects?
Yes. All the time, all over Asia. I have not seen them in the States. And
you know,
I
have seen them in the States in two places.
Oh, so you've seen them that?
Yeah, when I was a little boy, they showed up. There was things like that in our house a couple of times. I have very dim memories of that. And we used to see things like that in our cabin in upstate New York quite frequently.
We ask her, is your husband awake or where is he?
He's down sleeping, but I'm fascinated. Well,
wake him up. Have him tell us the rest of the story.
Oh, about the round eyes?
Yeah.
Well, he would see auras, too, over there, and we went to many temples. The shadows are to be in their culture, and they are accepted and spoken freely amongst the people and the government. That they are spirits that are passing. It's a form of Buddhism in the incarnation, and they're just getting ready to go to the next life. And the biggest thing I think I've learned over there was kinetic energy and how having positive kinetic energy in the heart and the passing of every moment upon awakening and upon sleeping is just good deeds, no matter what. If it's not stepping on an ant or baking a cake for the neighbor or going to the store with a smile or not, it's just good deed, one good deed after another good deed after another good deed with good positive kinetic energy. And
all right.
I believe.
Yeah,
that,
adopting a child for $22 a month.
Yep. That's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for that story, and that is a fascinating one. That's one for Unknown Country, Whitley.
It is, and you know, I was listening to the story. I was trying to remember, and so far it hasn't come clear in my mind exactly who I heard this from. But at some point in my life, someone said to me that after death, souls, their weight is everything. And the lighter they are, the lighter ones float off into higher realms. Most of them stay pretty much where they are, and those are the ones that get reincarnated in bodies, the ones that stay on the surface of the earth. The really bad ones go under. And you know, one of the eeriest stories I've really ever heard came from, of all people, Albert Speer, Hitler's architect.
Right, yeah.
Who witnessed the execution of numerous people at Spandau Prison after World War II of these terrible, monstrous Nazi criminals, and was made, after the executions, there was a dark mark in the floor of the gymnasium where the gallows had been built, under the gallows. And he was made to try to clean this blackness up. And he reports in his memoir that it could not be removed. And I thought to myself, maybe that was what was left as those souls sank down into the bowels of the earth forever.
Good point. East of the Rockies, it's your turn. Hi there.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. How y'all doing?
Good.
Fine, thank you.
This is Larry in Houston. My question to Whitley, that is your name, correct?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
All right. The bottleneck that occurred X number of years ago, I forget exactly, but the really severe one that knocked our genetic differences down to like 5%. Are y'all familiar with what I'm talking about?
No.
Well, there was some bottleneck in our human population. I forget how many years ago. It couldn't have been more than like 100,000 or 50,000 years ago.
Well, if you're referring to one of the instances where the human species dwindled to almost no creatures, they know of there were the most recent one was actually about 15,000 years ago, where the species was almost wiped off the planet by something, by some catastrophe, and there's evidence that other moments of, if it were genetic scarring, has taken place in the past. Yes.
I see. Well, the question is, do you think maybe one of these polar shifts, one of these magnetic shifts, might have been the culprit in that? Or
no, I do not. And the reason I don't is that we know that the last one was 750,000 years ago, and that's the timing is off. It's too far in the past.
First time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Yon from San Francisco. Hi, George. Hey, Whitley, I'm the guy with the Mary Poppins book today.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I really wanted to ask you. Previously, you've talked about your implant. You learned to use your implant as a tool, and I'm wondering if the visitors really are from possibly from other universes, if this might be a bridge, a way to contact them or do something like that, and I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit.
Sure. Well, in May of 1989... I was awakened about 1:30 or 2 in the morning. I was just falling off to sleep. I began to wake up, and I heard a male voice in the backyard. We were in our cabin, and the windows were open. It was a very pleasant night. Say, condition red. And, of course, a thrill of absolute terror went through me because this place was isolated, and hearing a voice outside in the backyard at that time of night, not good. And I had a bank of light switches that I had installed in this cabin beside my bed, which I could turn on just with a flick of my hand and light up the entire area around the cabin. I turned toward these switches and saw a man and a woman standing halfway into the bedroom at the foot of the bed. And the next thing I knew, I couldn't open my eyes. I was lying on my side, and there was on my right side, and there was pressure being applied to my left ear from above, and a voice speaking, and I don't remember what the voice was saying. And then there was, I recall, hearing there being a very bright light, and when I was able to move again, I heard crashing in the woods, like somebody running wildly off through the woods. And then the next thing I knew, it was morning. And I immediately told my wife about this. And she had no memory of anything. And when we went downstairs, the alarm system, we had not turned off the alarm system. I usually turned it off in the garage as I went out to get in the car and drive down to the little general store and get the paper.
Let's pick it up, Whitley, right from there when you went toward the alarm system. We'll be back. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, it'll be our Friday and the Saturday morning open lines. I'm looking forward to this one because who knows what those phones will bring. Back in a moment with Final Calls with Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast AM. And Whitley, we'll let you finish up your story before we go to the final calls. You're down there with an alarm system or something.
Right, and I walk out into the garage to get the paper, to get in the car, to drive down to get the paper, and to my amazement, the garage door is wide open, but the alarm system is still armed. And I perfectly well remember what happened the night before, and I think to myself, Lord, it really did happen, didn't it? So I disarm the alarm system. I go over and look at the door. There seems to be nothing wrong with it. In other words, it's all intact. And I get in the car to go out and get the paper. And I have backed about three-quarters of the way out of the garage. And I noticed that there was static electricity in that car to the point where there were sparks coming off my hands when I tried to touch the steering wheel. And I just got out of there. I figured, I don't know what's going on here, but obviously if this thing's going to explode, it's not going to do it with me inside. And I went back into the house, and Annie came out. We came back out and looked at the car. Seemed to be nothing wrong with it. I got in it again. It was fine. I got the paper, came home, called the alarm guy to come over and check the thing out. He comes over, and he finds that there is an incredibly very powerful magnetic field around the half of the switches, which is what prevented the thing from going off. But where did the magnetic field come from? So he replaced the switches, and it was fine after that. Then later that day, I began to get a pain in my left ear, and I touch it, and there's a lump in there that hadn't been there before. And it bothered me and bothered me. And I warded about it, and it got irritated from time to time. Finally, I guess it was about a year or so later, I was with Bill Mallow, who was then the director of material science at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, a very extraordinary scientist and extremely well-respected man. And he was quite interested in this stuff because he had a long history of work on classified things, and I guess he knew enough to know that there was something of interest in this. So the implant used to go off every once in a while. It would make a buzzing noise, and my ear would turn bright red. And it happened to do that in his office. And he rushed me into a signals acquisition laboratory, but we couldn't pick anything up from it in this laboratory, unfortunately. But then I decided, well, I'm getting this thing taken out of here because I'd rather not have this in there. So I got a doctor and he was on coast to coast with me at one point, Dr. Lerma, to remove the thing. And he opens an incision above the thing. It's totally stationary in there. There's no sense. It felt to him like a little cyst that was in the inside part of my ear, the outside part of my ear. But when he opened it, he sees a little white disc in there. He touches it with a scalpel, and it shoots down, migrates down into my earlobe, inches away from where it was.
It's moving on you.
Moved fast away from the scalpel, leaving a little edge of it on the scalpel, which he proceeds to collect, gives to me. I take it to Mallow, who calls me back the next day and says, under the microscope, it's got cilia on it. That is to say, little microscopic tentacles that would enable it to move. And I think, oh my, how much I want this out of my head.
Yeah, really.
And I think maybe I ought to just have the ear removed entirely.
or the head.
Yeah, there's a burning sensation. It moves back up into the original spot. And then I decided, maybe I better just leave it alone. Maybe something bad would happen to me if I removed it. So I left it there. And subsequently, it used to turn on and stuff, especially if I was looking at pictures of the grays, I could make it turn on by doing that. And that happened once in front of witnesses, quite a number of them. And then I began to be able to sort of, I think maybe sort of use it. I can't even articulate exactly what I mean because I'm not far enough along with it yet. But yes, I do think it might be some sort of communications device. And if I ever get that straightened out, I'll let people know in more detail. But it's been in my ear now for many years, and it hasn't hurt me. I've just accepted its presence. It's there right now as we speak.
And do you think it's biological or mechanical or both?
It's biomechanical, whatever it is.
On
my website, in fact, if you're a subscriber to my website, you can see a video of the doctor's attempt to remove it with Anne laughing away and everyone's very merry except me. You know, I'm just sort of sitting there because I'm hearing that it's not going to be able to be taken out. But the whole thing, everything I've described, is quite real. There's nothing false about it at all. It actually happened.
Let's go back to the calls. Wildcard line, you're on with Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah. Hey, guys. It's Donnie from Kentucky.
Sure.
Hey, George. Hey, Whitley.
Hi.
You know, Whitley, over the years, watching your progress and, you know, your awakening, so to speak, you've kind of fluctuated in your opinions of the visitors. And I, too, I think, have had, maybe you're the only one that can somewhat answer this. From childhood, I had an experience with a little creature from 4 to 6 that would come every 3 to 4 days, and visit. I'd sit and wait for him out the window, and kind of like an ET, you know, he could touch my finger and take me through walls. And I remembered saying how fascinating, we don't talk with our mouths, and him saying we didn't need to. He really looked like a Yoda character. I've shared it with very few people, but you know, in I've not met anyone else. There was so much love. I haven't met anyone else that's had such an incredible experience. To this day, it fascinates me and yet kind of appalls me. I loved this little person. I remember calling him my uncle and saying we must be related and him concurring. And I loved him more than I loved anyone in my family. When you hear about God love and an overwhelming sense of, you know, when folks describe guys going into the light, it was that kind of feeling. It was an addiction. I would cry at night when he didn't show up. When I tried to share it with my parents at bath time and all, my mom would say, no, honey, you can't have the same dream every night. So, of course, you know, sociologically, mom poo-pooed it. But he taught me many, many things, half of which I don't remember. I don't remember Grays in my world. But yet I must confess, Mr. Strieber, the first time walking with a briefcase through O'Hare Airport, mid-80s, looking at the bookstore, seeing all those wonderful covers of Communion and about having a heart attack, freezing in my tracks, you know, and people bumping into my backside, and I was frozen. I couldn't walk. So I knew at that point I had had great experiences, though I think I didn't want to recognize them. And I, too, had an implant at the age of 12 in the late 70s, a corkscrew hole in my knee. Don't know if anything's in there, but it wouldn't heal. Woke up with blood in the bed. It didn't hurt. But it took about 9 months to heal, and it was in Europe, and they refused to allow me to go in the swimming pool because it wouldn't heal. So what I'm wondering, to summarize all this, is I remember that overwhelming love and passion and the amount of information about the future and visuals that this fellow gave me. I guess you'd call them holograms. And I've never been able to share it with anyone, but I've asked individuals that are contactees, have you ever had pleasant experiences, overwhelmingly more beautiful than anything you've had on Earth? And those people usually say with fear, watch out, they're the great tricksters. What is your opinion on that?
Well, I would assume that whatever it is, whatever they are, and there are many forms besides the Grays, including human forms, by the way, that could and I'm sure do walk among us every day, that among all of these different forms, there must be an incredible complexity of different attitudes and approaches, some of which are probably very dark and negative and difficult for us to deal with, others of which range from in every conceivable area emotionally and in terms of attitudes towards us. Some of them probably think of us as fellow humans and beings gifted with souls, and others probably think of us as little more than lab animals. And if you think of how if anyone from Earth could go to another planet where they did not understand us and did not know where we were from or how we got there, can you imagine how many different experiences the people on that planet, the beings on that planet, would have with us, considering how different we all are and the different ideologies and beliefs they might have? communists show up. They might have people from different religions show up, or different ideologies, political ideologies and belief systems. It would be an extraordinarily confusing experience for them. And the one thing that they couldn't do would be to say, oh, well, all the ETs do this or all of them do that, because it's not true. And that certainly was my experience. My first experiences with the visitors were very rough. And yet I kind of, when I, over the 11 years of fairly frequent close encounters, I felt like it was it felt more like trying to tame an animal, if you can imagine, that was smarter than me. And there was a sense of regard. I wouldn't say I never felt any kind of transcendent love like that, but I got comfortable with them. I mean, they were friends after a while. I trusted them, and my wife and I had no trouble trusting our child with them. And what was so extraordinary, I told the other parents, his friends' parents, in detail what was happening and what the children were seeing up there. And the children, of course, told their parents, too. And not once did any parent have any sense that their child shouldn't go there and participate in that. So on some deep level, it seemed to be very acceptable to people. And yet, at the same time, I know stories, absolutely terrifying stories. And my initial experiences were terrifying also.
I had Jacques Vallée on the program a couple of weeks ago, and it's amazing, Whitley, to see his metamorphosis, to go from, you know, hardline ETs to where he believes they're dimensional creatures.
Well, you know, he's a very prescient man, and I'm thinking also, especially with this material about parallel universes that we talked about earlier in the show, which is so stunning, that may be the answer. But I had an experience, and we have just, I'll be very brief with this, we have just about time for it, I think. Back in that time when my son was young, I was taking one of his friends to meet his father in Paramus, New Jersey, coming down from upstate New York, and he had his place down in the Delaware Water Gap. And we used to trade boys in Paramus. There's just sort of midway between the two country houses. And at this particular juncture, I was taking his little boy just to meet him. My son was staying at home, and he was going, they were going on a trip or something. And I would take him to a certain diner in Paramus, and come down the divided highway, take an exit, drive over the highway, come back a couple miles, and go to the diner. And as we drove past the diner on the way down, I could see his father's truck sitting in there. We came off the highway, and instead of being on a flat road that then turned and enabled an up ramp to go across the highway, we ended up going down into a sunken highway that I had never been on before. And I immediately took the first exit I saw, because I figured I've taken a wrong turn.
Right.
And which I certainly had. The next thing I knew, we were in this neighborhood, wide streets, dappled, big trees, dappled sunlight coming down, and on the set well back from the streets were these houses that were sort of like block houses. They were long and low. It looked like they'd made of sandstone, and they had big serpents kind of engraved in their sides. They were not like anything I'd ever seen in this world. The little boy kept trying to open the door, and I was afraid he was going to jump out. So I was closing the lock down, and he was pulling it up, and I was closing it down. It was an automatic locking system. In the meantime, I saw some cars off in the distance and went through a rather rough area where there were no more houses. It was like a big, open, vacant area. We found ourselves on Route 80, 20 miles from where we'd left the highway just a few minutes before. And I took him back. We didn't say anything. I was hoping he hadn't really registered with him, because his father was very skeptical about this stuff, and I didn't think he wanted to hear anything like this. So the fella doesn't say anything on the way back to the diner. By the time we get to the diner, his dad's really looking for us, because it's been a while. And the little boy jumps out of the car and goes running off across the tarmac, saying to his, yelling out, "Daddy, Daddy, Whitley took me on a ride through the Twilight Zone." And I have to tell you, George, maybe it's possible to move between parallel universes, but the dark universe in my book in 2012 is based on that journey, because the houses looked like there was something about the snakes on them. It made me feel a sense of the presence of the reptiles somehow. It was very eerie.
That is eerie, and I got to tell you, the reptilian feeling is not the one you want, is it?
Not really. No, as I said earlier in the show, I figured they'd be pretty cranky if they were basically reptiles, because you don't see too many reptiles that look particularly happy. I mean, they're not like dogs.
Yeah, that's true. I don't see a lot of people petting them unless you have an iguana. Right?
Iguanas are cool. They're very different. Yeah, that's very true.
Hey, Whitley, we're out of time. Where do you get the book, 2012?
You get the book anywhere. It's in bookstores all over the country. There are signed copies at Borderlands Books in San Francisco, at the Tattered Cover in Denver, at some of the Barnes & Nobles in Denver. In New York, there might be a few left at East West Books. You can probably get it from Amazon.com. It's all over.
And soon to be a movie, too?
Yep. The same team that made Transformers are making it into a movie.
Oh, that's exciting. Whitley Strieber. Thanks, Whitley. Appreciate you being on the program.
A pleasure, George. It was fabulous.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.